You've got some good men here, Taylor.
Too good, perhaps, sir?
We're mainly concerned with a man's ability to withstand stress, pain, and so on.
Oh, that's a matter of temperament, sir. Difficult to estimate. Now, this is a machine we copied from the Germans, which is supposed to test determination, courage, and so on. Would you care to try it, sir?
No, thank you. I'm sure Major Spence would be delighted.
Mm. Very well. You've no heart trouble, Major Spence,
no.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Trudeau cocking a snook at Trump from Canada. Yes, it must be NATO's 70th birthday bash in London. But when those NATO leaders put their heads together, are they really concerned for our defence or for starting the next war? Might it be a small war? Like turning Libya over to the law of the jungle? Or a big war? As tensions simmer between politically deadlocked Israel and Iran, not a lot of talk in this general election campaign about whether party leaders would support another US-led war in the Middle East. We talk tonight about Tony Blair and George Bush's Iraq war, how and why that war was illegal, why neither have faced prosecutions for the same offences that sent Nazis to the gallows at Nuremberg. And one man that was sentenced there in absentia, Hitler's private secretary, Nazi party treasurer Martin Bormann. For those enjoying our digging dirt on Hitler's Reichsleiter, secretly rescued from Berlin, many say, by Ian Fleming and the Royal Navy. More evidence on Hitler's obsequious private secretary, who stayed in the shadows. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon. This week, a Jewish American's defence of Palestinian human rights. Fascinating talk by former Northampton University International Relations lecturer Ron Mandel, now residing here in Bristol. You can listen here at BCFM noon next Tuesday, or download the show right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, I hope I'm joined on the line by Catherine Gunn. Hi, Catherine. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Catherine. Now, for people that don't know, you were involved as a whistleblower at GCHQ in the run-up to the 2003 attack on Iraq. Now, for many people, this is seen as a horrific event, and not just because so many people turned up in London, but estimates between 1 and 2 million people, the biggest demonstration ever to try and stop a war. So I suppose the first question is, do you consider yourself a spy when you're working at GCHQ? Are you actually a spy?
It's a term that is used for myself, and I guess people think of anybody within the intelligence services as a spy, but you know, my concept of a spy is more the kind of MI6 variety or the MI5 variety, where they're actually running agents and so on. So I wouldn't consider myself a spy. No, I'm a civil servant, or I was a civil servant.
But I mean, hang on a minute, because some of those Bond characters, they might say, well, we're just civil servants too. I mean, you're listening in on people's communications, aren't you?
Yes. I'm still bound by the Official Secrets Act.
Oh, so you can't say too much about what... Anyway, look, how do you get a job as a spy? That's the obvious thing to ask. I mean, you're only just up the road here, an hour's drive away in Cheltenham. How does someone get a job up there?
Well, for me, it was pretty straightforward. I mean, in terms of advertising, it was an advert I saw, and I think it was the Guardian newspaper. And they specifically were asking for linguists, Mandarin, Russian, Arabic speakers. And I thought it sounded interesting at the time. It was back in 2000. I just recently graduated from university and I was looking for work where I could use lingual language skills.
So, I mean, you spoke Mandarin. I mean, where did you get your language skills from? Sounds, I mean, what drove you to get to learn these languages?
Well, I had no choice in the matter. I was three at the time that my dad, who studied as a mature student, Mandarin Chinese at university, and he decided to take my mum and myself, aged three, to live in Taiwan. And that's how I learned Mandarin, the easy way as a child. So I'm not complaining about that.
What about GCHQ working at Cheltenham? Was it like a normal job?
Well, I mean, it was fairly mundane, to be honest, where I worked. And, you know, it was a kind of cross-section of skill sets, if you like. There were linguists, mathematicians, general managers and technician types. You know, it was kind of, I felt quite at ease there because I had grown up on a university campus. And so I was used to dealing with or meeting people of academic nature. And so it kind of had that same sort of vibe about it, I suppose.
What about when the whistleblowing part of this, just in the run-up to the Iraq war? I mean, it's made quite clear in the film that, and also, of course, in the reporting at the time, that there was an attempt to get the United States, made an attempt to get the Security Council fixed, basically, a vote at the Security Council. Now, I mean, you know, for most of us watching the film or seeing, you know, what happened in the Iraq war, I suppose this is what we understood. That the security services of all sorts, whether it's you know, running spies, MI6, this kind of thing, or GCHQ, when the chips are down, that's your job, is to go and make sure they get that vote, come what may.
Well, no, I mean, I don't agree. I think you know, though, at the time when I made the leak, and this is what would have come out in the trial, I think, if the trial had not been dismissed, the case against me, we would have argued that at the time, the Attorney General himself had believed that an invasion of Iraq would have been illegal. And so therefore, me having leaked that information about this ongoing operation at the UN against UN diplomats was actually justified because the Attorney General himself, we now know from 2010 when his legal advice, first set of legal advice came out eventually, we now know that he judged that invasion to be illegal at first and then he subsequently changed his mind.
Was there a moment where you thought, crikey, I'm going to have to stick my neck out here?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you know, in a day-to-day, you're going to work, you're going backwards and forwards to work. Was there a moment that you thought, well, you know, this is, it's time to actually do something, to step outside my role as just as simply as a civil servant, and I'm going to blow the whistle?
Well, nothing had occurred to me until I actually saw that email from NSA, and that was the only instance that I felt I had to, up until that point, I felt I had, that was a line I wasn't willing to cross. And that's why I felt it had to come out, and it was, you know, necessary for the public to know about it.
Okay, we're going to have a listen now to a clip from the film, and I'll just ask you afterwards, Catherine, just how accurate you think the film, you know, in this particular instance was, because this is the moment where your boss calls everyone together and says, okay, some information has leaked out of this office, I need to know who it was, and you've got to tell me right now. So let's have a listen to that.
Mm-hmm. Someone in this building has betrayed their government and their country. Now, I'm sure it wasn't anyone in this division, but starting today, internal security will be conducting interviews with each and every one of you. If you know anything or suspect anyone, it is your sworn duty to speak up. If you do not, and you are found to have withheld information of any kind, you will be charged with a breach of the Official Secrets Act.
Well, I mean, it sounds a little bit almost like being hauled the whole school in front of the headmaster or something. Did something like that actually really happen?
Not that I recall, but once I came into work on the Monday morning, and remember, by this time I was already an utter mess of nerves because I knew that my position was compromised. And so, you know, when I arrived, I was...
Sorry, Kathleen, how did you know that? How did you know you were somehow going
to
be...
Not me immediately, specifically, but... that it was very much narrowed down. The way that the information came out in the Observer was not how I had pictured it would be coming out. So they basically reprinted the memo, and you know that meant that GCHQ instantly, as soon as it was released, knew that it came from GCHQ, and only 100 people or so received that email. So it really narrowed it down to a certain number of people. And, you know, you may think 100 is still quite a lot, but I literally felt like I had a target on my back. So going in to work on Monday, you know, there was already, as soon as I entered, I mean, people come in from like 7 o'clock in the morning. Some people are early to work. I tended to go in at 9, and there were already people being interviewed. So...
one of the things I've always wanted to ask you, because we obviously following the story at the time in 2003, it looked like there was this kind of nervous gap between you actually blowing the whistle to the Observer newspaper and then nothing actually appearing in the newspaper. That must have been pretty nerve-wracking too.
Well, yeah, so the email came out, or at least I received it on the 31st of January. And then I printed it a few days later, so the following Monday. It was a Friday, and I printed it on the Monday. And then, that's right, it didn't come out till the 2nd of March. So it was about a month of not knowing what had happened to it, really, apart from the fact that I'd passed it on to my contact, and that was it. That was as much as I knew.
So did you think maybe it would never come out?
At some level I did, after a couple of weeks of checking. I mean, obviously, I didn't expect it to come out sort of straight away, but I checked maybe a week later and a week after that, and I kept sort of browsing the newspapers and so on. And then I went on the march that, you know, you described as one of the biggest in history. And at that point, I thought, you know, well, the people have spoken, so really does it matter if I leaked anything? Because this is it. This is, you know, Tony Blair's not surely his sort of, you know, wish to remain popular and have sort of the popular vote is going to seriously be affected by this march.
But the fact of the matter is, quite a lot of people say that this did make a difference in that it meant that because certain people on the Security Council may have voted against the motion for war, when otherwise they might have gone along with it if you hadn't leaked that document. What do you think?
Ultimately, yes. The memo prevented people, specifically the Chileans, but also the Mexicans, from... participating in any UN process about Iraq, any resolution that would authorize an invasion. So I think that is true to say, and that's a small consolation. But, you know, really, it's one of the biggest crimes against humanity that we've seen in the start of the 21st century.
What's it like seeing yourself portrayed on the screen by Keira Knightley and in that way? What was your experience first sitting down and watching the film?
Well, it's obviously it's very bizarre. I mean, the first I've only watched it twice. I mean, I know people who've watched it several more times than I have. The first time I watched it, I felt almost like I was a critic. So I was kind of watching it with a critical eye and trying to, you know, just sort of thinking to myself, oh, my office didn't look like this. My boss wasn't quite like this. And, you know, and just comparing the reality with what was on the screen. Although I still did enjoy it. But the second time I watched it, I really got sucked into it. And I really felt Keira Knightley's performance, and I really sort of felt sympathetic towards her. Yeah, it was quite bizarre, but it sort of felt like I was watching somebody else's experience that was very similar to mine.
Well, there may be other whistleblowers who might also enjoy watching the film in that case. But anyway, look, there was one scene in there where your husband is about to be deported, which is unbelievable, really. I mean, it seemed that there was the establishment were trying any sort of trick, basically, to isolate you. Did that actually happen?
Yeah, that did happen. But, I mean, it really had nothing to do with a sort of retaliation from the state. I mean, it just so happened that, you know, I was married to a man. We'd only recently got married, it was due process that he was being deported, I think, because his visa status, his asylum claim had been denied, and so this was the natural progression of events. The silver lining of the cloud is that had I not have been in the position I was in, had I still been working at GCHQ, he would have been deported. So the weird thing is that actually the fact that I was facing a criminal prosecution meant that they didn't deport him at that moment in time.
I mean, as a sort of classic whistleblower, Catherine, how would you advise people to get information, documents to newspapers? Because this seems to be, you know, obviously there is lots and lots of other people who possibly would like to blow the whistle, but they're just afraid of losing their job. So what lessons did you learn from your experience?
Well, I think the fact of the matter is that most people don't. I mean, from what I can gather is that, yes, people have probably wished that they had done, but because they know it's really the risks are so high, they've chosen their family, they've chosen their career over the information that they thought needed to come out. Now, that's totally understandable. And I think the only way we can really justifiably call for people to come forward is if we have a complete reforming of the Official Secrets Act and protection for potential whistleblowers, because there really isn't a fail-safe way to do it at this point in time. You really have to be so clued up about what information can be deciphered from different ways of, you know, revealing it, and whether you do it digitally or doing it by printing stuff out. I mean, there's all manner of ways of being found out, and I think, you know, that's what puts people off nowadays.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is there any point where you really kicked yourself and you said, oh, I should have done it differently?
Well, you know, Martin Bright has always joked that I should have gone directly to the paper and to himself. Because that would have, A, saved them a lot of time in terms of verifying and checking the authenticity of the document. And also they would have advised me. But you know, the reality is they probably would have advised me that once they publish, you know, the likelihood is that these events would happen. And that actually might have put a damper on my enthusiasm in getting the information out. So anyway, characteristically, I wouldn't have gone to a journalist anyways, because, you know, we're also told at GCHQ never to talk to journalists, never to trust them, never to, you know, befriend them. So I was I was already incredibly sort of skeptical towards journalists at that stage.
Well, your thing is you're caught between two stools there, aren't you? I mean, you've got potentially your bosses in the GCHQ that you might or might not be able to trust, and possible journalists that you can't trust or might not be able to. But look, one of the questions that anyone, you know, anything to do with signals intelligence wants to know is whether the law is good enough to stop people like GCHQ, the NSA, actually spying on citizens. And we're talking now about, you know, what used to be anyway, protected people such as journalists, lawyers, MPs, people like that.
I think the law is very unclear. And I think the select committees that specifically sort of have oversight on these issues are not... dare I say, don't have enough teeth. I think it's, especially with the prosecution of Julian Assange, you can see that there is this chilling effect now. And in fact, the fact that it has been, I think in a previous recent case, I'm just trying to think of the one where they've said that journalists and their sources could also be charged. And I think although this happened previously with journalists like Guardian journalists like or Observer journalists like Martin Bright with the Shayla case, they were able to defend themselves. But I think there's definitely been a chilling effect more recently, which is quite worrying.
Look, I mean, bringing up Assange, this is a weird one, isn't it? Because he's being prosecuted under these Secret Service type laws affecting the Secret Service. Actually, he's really not a spy. He's someone who receives information, like maybe Martin Bright or somebody, from leakers. And that, you know, there's apparently no public interest defence. But anyway, what do you make of this Assange case?
I think the whole thing has been really, really appallingly... it's a shocking example of power gone mad. And I think, you know, it's at this very late stage now where his life is in jeopardy. Really, anyone who had any quibbles about his character or anything about the accusations that had been made against him previously should really... put that to one side. I mean, that's already been dismissed, basically, and focus on what is quite clearly a politically motivated persecution and defend the man before it's too late.
I mean, we've also got a lot of evidence that, and this has not really been reported much by the London so-called Fleet Street, is Julian Assange's judge and her husband have links to the British military establishment, that, and they were actually exposed by WikiLeaks, ironically. The husband of Lady Emma Arbuthnot, the Westminster Chief Magistrate overseeing WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's extradition to the US, has financial links to the British military establishment, according to institutions and individuals exposed by WikiLeaks. It can also be revealed, so says Declassified UK, that Lady Arbuthnot has received gifts and hospitality in relation to her husband, including from military and cybersecurity company exposed by WikiLeaks. Now, this does suggest that maybe even the whole entire justice system has been compromised, Catherine. And well, I wonder what you make from your experience with the justice system, if this is so surprising.
Well, it's certainly very concerning about Julian's case. I mean, in my case, there are also a lot of questions that are still unanswered, and a lot of things that we would like answers to. For example, you know, a simple question of why did they drop the charges against me? That is one question that we've never had a satisfactory answer to.
Why do you think they dropped them? I mean, you must have some kind of inkling.
Well, our suspicions are that principally it was the Attorney General's advice that hadn't leaked and didn't leak for a subsequent 6 years after that, which clearly, if it had come out at that early stage in 2004, would have really made a difference, I think, to the political sort of landscape around the Iraq war, the discussions about the Iraq war, if that had come out so soon. It was also only a year until the next general election. And if the trial had gone ahead, you know, it would have been a highly political trial that would have examined the Iraq war and put a lot of focus on that. And also, I don't think they really wanted to even test the defense of necessity that we were prepared to put in court as a means of defending me. They didn't even want that tested under the Official Secrets Act in case it set a precedent. So, I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities, but it would be, you know, other than the fact that they've said recently, the former prosecutor, the Crown prosecution, Ken MacDonald, Sir Ken MacDonald, said recently in an article that it was due to national security. Well, I mean, that's just a sort of blanket coverall, isn't it?
What about, well, we're on the cusp of a general election now. Some say voting changes very little, especially some people in this city, Catherine, I speak to. What did you learn about how power really works from your experience?
Oh, wow. I mean, again, the Attorney General's hand is all over my case because Official Secrets Act cases are always decided by the Attorney General, and he was a close friend, an ally of Tony Blair. And of course, his word was what gave Tony Blair the go-ahead on whether or not to invade Iraq. And again, it was his word or his judgment on whether or not to charge and then subsequently to drop my case. So, I mean, all these sorts of characters, these figures, they obviously, clearly, they're all very closely linked at the top. And so, you know, these things have an effect on their ability to make decisions and right and moral decisions.
And what about when that case was dropped? Did it just hit you like a bombshell? Because you'd obviously put a lot of time into preparing to fight it, and then suddenly it was almost like the phantom before you vanished.
Yes, it was very, very bizarre experience because on the one hand, it was a huge relief. I mean, I can't describe how much of a relief it was because really I had been living under this dark cloud for a whole year. But on the other hand, I have to admit, even to this day, I almost feel as though I would quite like to go back into court and fight my case because, it was, you know, so there were so many good points, so many relevant points that we could have put, and so much would have come out at the time back then, I think, that really would have made a really big difference to the whole narrative of the Iraq war, subsequent accountability, and so on.
Do you think they could get away with something like that again, another war, illegal war?
Well, I hope to goodness they don't, but that doesn't mean any of us should be laid back about it. I think the public mood is such that really everybody is utterly sick and tired of it. I mean, it's British men and women who are sent to the front lines, and not the politicians themselves. I think most, you know, the fact that, and especially in the US as well, I mean, the fact that there are now so many thousands of combat veterans who you know, are really suffering at home, and not to mention all the ones, all the civilians in overseas who are suffering, all the Iraqis, all the Libyans and the Syrians and so on. So I think, you know, that really we are all sick and tired of war and we want it to stop. But, you know, the elites, the people who with powers that should not have the powers, are really going to have to, you know, listen. Otherwise, I don't know where we're headed.
What about Bush and Blair? Do you think we'll ever see justice done for all the million or so Iraqis that died, at least that we know of, after that war? Will they ever go to jail?
Obviously, it would be good, because I think that would really show a transformation, a political will, and a transformative will that would go some way towards alleviating the sort of feelings of just disillusionment with the political process and with political power. But no, I mean, I just, it's not going to happen. I mean, I think Tony Blair, obviously, I mean, it would be great if somebody could arrest him if he goes abroad, or civilian arrest. I know they've tried, but it's highly unlikely.
As far as I know, it's just Malaysia is the only place that Bush and Blair can't go, because there was a trial in Malaysia, as I understand it, for war crimes against those two. Maybe the Malaysians can send some of their secret agents and stuff Blair into a plane and get him to go to Kuala Lumpur. Anyway, look, final question, Catherine, would you do it again? Because it was obviously a really traumatic experience over several years.
I've always said I would, and I think I would, because, you know, you never know what your actions will achieve. You do them for the right reasons. And for me, it was a sort of instinctive thing to prevent sort of this awful, awful war that we've witnessed unfold over 16, 17 years. And so I think, you know, you've got to try, if that's the only thing you can do.
Okay, well, GCHQ whistleblower Catherine Gunn, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show. And everyone listening, hopes you can get to see the film over Christmas sometime. Or is it on DVD, Catherine?
I think it's currently out on Netflix or on the digital services. And shortly after that, I think it will be on DVD.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, Martin, interesting talking to Catherine there. And of course, in the possible run-up to another war in the future, this doesn't seem as if, because there hasn't been justice in this case, mm-hmm. that maybe the same could happen again.
Well, it's pretty clear that it could. You know, what's actually happened is the deep state, both here and in the US, has, you know, learnt its lessons from their point of view, from what happened last time. And, you know, the persecution of Assange is a way of trying to, you know, to prevent any whistleblowers from daring to come forward, because the journalists themselves can now be arrested, never mind the whistleblowers. And, of course, there's an awful lot of psychological warfare going on out there.
So is it going to happen or not? Do you think there does do seem to be moves in the Middle East, particularly with the Israelis and the Iranians, and tensions are mounting. We've got also the West's various Royal Navy projection of power into the Gulf, this sort of thing. The US Navy, they seem to be taking a specific interest in the Middle East still. Why is this?
Well, it's a strategic place, that's why, and that's why wars happen, is because it's in somebody's interest for them to happen. The arms industry makes money, win or lose, and a lot of the politicians, for example, end up on the boards of the companies that supply the weapons, and it's basically their meal ticket. So you've just got that basically venal reason for having wars, and then you've got the more strategic reasons. And, you know, General Wesley Clark said that there's a decision has been taken to several countries are going to be attacked. Iran is definitely in the firing line. And, of course, if they get Iran, if they manage to attack Iran and succeed, which, of course, is a very big if, they're trying to take down the Russians and the Chinese, because they don't want to have a multipolar world where various different people are allowed to have different policies from the ones pursued by Wall Street and Washington. And that's the bottom line.
What about the film? Are you going to see the film?
I haven't seen it, but I would like to see it. Yes, it sounds very interesting. And, of course, no doubt it's not really being pushed with the same enthusiasm as Frozen 2 and all the other mainstream stuff that people go to cinemas to see.
What do you think about GCHQ as well? I mean, there was a whole battle over trade unions there, wasn't there? I think it was in the 1980s.
Yeah.
It's only just up the road.
Yeah, well, the GCHQ workers were civil servants. They were classified as civil servants, and they were represented by the civil service unions. And, of course, the Thatcher regime, if I can call it a regime, because it was, really, they never actually got a majority of the votes in this country.
We call anything that we don't like, apparently, a regime. And if we do like it, it's a government.
Yeah, but the point is they never actually got 50% plus one of the votes. And if it was Denmark or Ireland, they wouldn't have been the government. But there you go. But the point is they then banned trade unions from GCHQ, a ban which they managed to persist to this day. I would like to think that we probably do need to have some kind of intelligence service, and GCHQ has a function, but it's got to be, as the old saying says, who will guard the guardians? If they're going to have secret state guarding us, somebody's got to keep an eye on them, haven't they?
Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
The big news of the week is NATO's 70th birthday, Martin. NATO, not one of your favourite organisations, and no. I don't think you sent them a birthday present, did you?
No, I didn't send them a card either.
But it also is quite a lot of acrimony, actually. I mean, how much do you think that's real, and how much is it faux acrimony? Macron saying that NATO was strategically brain dead. Is this real?
Yes, it's real. There are tensions within the Western alliance. The Americans, the US, of course, Latin Americans don't regard North America as just the only America. They are basically cracking the whip. And other countries, France in particular, are not necessarily that happy about that. There's going to be discussions, I believe, this week or next week between Putin and Zelensky to try and resolve the Ukraine issue. And Macron and Merkel are what they call the Normandy Four altogether, are basically mediating in that. And of course the Americans, the US, basically stirred the whole thing up in the first place by carrying out the coup in 2014.
Anyway, BBC's Jonathan Beale did a little summary on, I think it was on the World Service of the 70th birthday. And the most important thing, as usual, so interesting with London journalists, they use the best bit till last.
When NATO came into being, there were just a dozen members and one clear threat, the old Soviet Union. 70 years on, there are 29 members with increasingly divergent views. President Macron had angered allies when he described NATO as strategically brain dead. It was a call for clearer political direction. In response, the final declaration proposed a forward-looking reflection process. Vague, but something to ensure the French leader did not leave empty-handed. Turkey's President Erdogan had threatened to veto a defence plan for the Baltic states and Poland if allies failed to recognise Kurdish forces in Syria as a threat, even though those same forces have been crucial in the fight against ISIS. The Turkish president backed down, but the final declaration made careful reference to tackling terrorism in all its forms. Eastern European states were reassured by mention of Russia's aggressive actions, but there was also talk of the need for dialogue. There was a restatement for allies to share the costs of collective defence, as long demanded by President Trump. For the first time, China was named as a potential challenge.
Well, I mean,
China.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is currently deploying forces in the Hindu Kush in Afghanistan.
Well, so the thing is, North Atlantic doesn't really come very close to the South China Sea, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Or the Pacific.
No.
Or the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, and of course, what could have happened at the end of the Cold War, when the Warsaw Pact was basically disbanded, is that NATO could have been disbanded and a collective security structure could have been created, which included the, and in fact, Putin, when he first came to power, was suggesting, well, why can't Russia join NATO? Or we'll have to call it something else, but we can all be in the same structure. But of course, that wasn't acceptable to the Western powers.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization,
they don't want
that. A lot of the people involved in that were actually former Nazis, weren't they?
Well, indeed.
Including one of the Secretaries General of NATO, who had previously been a general in the Wehrmacht, for example, and people who are connected with the SS, etc. Mm-hmm. So what about the speculation, and I think we can only call it that, really, that NATO was specifically born out of links between the Allies and the SS, for example?
Well, I mean, it's quite clear that the Nazi German intelligence structure was integrated into NATO as it was created. So Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head up the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, becomes the head of the BND, the West German intelligence services. And, you know, we've covered this linkage going back, you know, there's lots of evidence to show that this went on. And don't forget, the Warsaw Pact was only formed in response to the creation of NATO. It wasn't the Warsaw Pact formed first and NATO second. That was the other way around. And there was a possibility at the end of the war of some kind of common security policy. Very difficult to do with Stalin's Russia, to be fair. But then, you know, the modern Soviet Union under Gorbachev and today the democratic Russia, why can't we just have a partnership with them to deal with various problems of mutual concern?
So one person, SS Oberst Gruppenführer, Paul Hauser, he was the World War II's Das Reich Division commander and SS general. He publicly stated that NATO grew out of the international brigades of the SS. And that was quoted by A.J. Barker in the book Waffen-SS at War. What he actually said was SS Obergruppenführer Paul Hauser, and he says, and he's pictured there as an Obergruppenführer whilst commanding Das Reich Division in Russia in the winter of 1941, unquestionably the ablest military commander in the Waffen-SS. Well, I would imagine there are some questions about that. But after the war, he sought to re-establish the reputation of the SS and claimed that the foreign units of the SS were really the precursors of the NATO army.
Well, also the stay-behind networks that were created by the Germans, the so-called werewolf networks. As you know, Tony, you've got a book, you've shown it to me. Those networks became the Gladio networks, which then engaged in terrorism in Western Europe, assassinating politicians in Belgium, blowing up banks and railway stations in Italy, the assassination of Aldo Moro. All of this is basically Nazi psychological warfare technique being employed by NATO. And of course, Imbozzi Marto, the former head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book about all of this that came out in 2012.
So the idea is using terrorism of various sorts to define the narrative. In other words, carrying out a bomb attack, blaming it, using the media to blame it on and the establishment to blame it on whoever it is, in order to get a particular narrative and political change and action.
That's right. So basically, some of the techniques that the Nazis used in their rise to power were honed and perfected and then used by NATO's intelligence structure to steer Western society in a certain direction. And the evidence for this is overwhelming. People just have to put in Gladio into their search engine and loads of stuff will come up, including films, books, etc. But the mainstream political debate, as we run into a general election in this country, is all about froth, not serious.
And what is, I wonder, the Labour's Shadow Foreign Secretary, Emily Thornberry, saying about all of this? Well, she was on the TV earlier this week talking about NATO and the Labour policy towards it.
Jeremy Corbyn on the Jeremy Vine show today said it was tit for tat for the Warsaw Pact and it deepened the Cold War. I mean, whatever you say about Donald Trump, he's more in favour of NATO than your party leader is.
But Jeremy was talking about NATO in the past. What we need to talk about is NATO's future. And what we said in the 2017 manifesto and in the 2019 manifesto is that we are committed to NATO. Now, listen to me, changes. There are all kinds of things that NATO could be doing. They could strengthen itself by modernising. For example, you know, one of the biggest threats...
About NATO in the past, I mean, this is important, isn't it? This is about history. Deepening of the Cold War. It is the existence of NATO that, to a large extent, allowed the Cold War to be won by the West without a single shot being fired.
What's important is ensuring that we keep our country safe now. What's important is what Labour would do to make sure that we keep our country safe.
Has Jeremy Corbyn got his history correct or not on this one?
Jeremy Corbyn is correct.
to support NATO. That is what's in our manifesto, and it was in our last manifesto.
So really, effectively, what she's saying there is that there's no difference between this and the Tory policy towards NATO.
Well, because what's happened in this country is the establishment, and using mechanisms like terrorism and control of the media, make the whole idea of NATO a shibboleth that we're not allowed to challenge.
Well, why should we challenge it when it won the Cold War without a single shot being fired?
Well, they tell that to the people who died in Bologna Railway Station. That was not a shot, that was a bomb. And of course, NATO in fact orchestrated the shootings in the Maidan Square in 2014. There's been court cases in Kiev, which is quite clear what happened there. NATO intelligence services shot down those pro-EU demonstrators in order to carry out a coup. That was 80-odd people killed and police officers. That
was NATO.
And what
evidence have you got that NATO did that?
Because there's been
Georgians.
A court case in Kiev, and Kiev is controlled by the...
That court case said it was done by Georgians. They're not
The Georgians were brought in with Shakashvili because he was working for the NATO intelligence services with an American on the ground who was actually coordinating the snipers. Now, this is when they say we won the Cold War without a shot being fired, tell that to the Vietnamese. Tell that to the Afghans. Tell that to all the people in Mozambique and Angola that died in the.
None of these places are in Eastern Europe, are they?
No, but in Eastern Europe. Tell that to the people in Yugoslavia, where NATO basically connived to break the country up to prevent the Russians having a geopolitical victory there. So, in other words, lots and lots of people died in the Cold War. Who didn't die in the Cold War are comfortable people, wealthy people living in the West. They just watched it all on television. So for them, it was a victory.
So it does seem as if the precedent's been set back in 2003 for a major war to be launched by the NATO allies without a Security Council resolution. Does that mean UN Security Council is no longer relevant?
That's right. Well, what's happened is there's been a gradual... This is why the Russians are so keen on sticking to the letter of international law, because the Western powers don't want to stick to the letter of international law.
Got something to gain from it, the Russians.
Well, they want international law because it's in their interest and it's in everybody else's interest as well. But the West tries to pretend that they are above international law and that they can just throw it out of the window when it suits them. And of course, that is because they want to attack people. They want to take down the Chinese regime. They want the Russian regime changed. They want a change of regime in Iran. The Israelis want to annex the Golan Heights. They've already annexed them. They want to annex the West Bank. They want a war. Now, ultimately, of course, if you're not a pacifist, you have to fight, and the other side will fight back.
Well, there was a mini war last week, wasn't there, about this time last week on the streets of London, out after a meeting in Fishmongers Hall and a terrorist attack on London Bridge. Now, before we hear your comments on that, as various things have come out during the week, particularly about the two people that were killed in Fishmongers Hall, we're told, as a result of it all. And let's have a listen now to, actually, I thought one of the interesting angles on it is that the prison service has been severely cut, and so it's quite feasible that the people are being let out before time because there simply isn't enough staff to look after them and room in the prison. So let's have a listen now to a chap who's the ex-parole board chief, Nick Hardwick, talking on the terror attacker from London Bridge last week this time.
Well, the backdrop is that the prison system has been facing an enduring crisis, as the Cross-Party Justice Committee said only a month ago. And that's principally because of the loss of experienced staff. So the government is now trying to recruit new staff, but they can't replace the experience that's been lost. And it's that experience that's critical to managing the most dangerous prisoners. People have been, and I myself and others, have been warning about the dangers in the prison system for a long time. It's neglected. I think it's been a case of out of sight, out of mind. And now the chickens are coming home to roost. And this is not, as I say, just a matter for the prison service, but it's also been a similar situation in the probation service.
Well, I think those points are very well made. I mean, the prison service is basically a Cinderella service. People want people to be put in prison for various reasons, and probably a good reason to put some people in there, but they don't want to pay for it. And when they want money spent, they want it spent on something that they like rather than things that they don't like. But if you compare our prison system, for example, to the Norwegian prison system, which is better, much better funded, and they actually rehabilitate prisoners, and their prisons are actually quite, from our point of view, quite soft
prison. Okay, we've seen a prosecution this week in the US. Bizarrely, the British were over there from the National Crime Agency too. Brian Benchowski from the US Department of Justice and Rob Jones we're about to hear from the National Crime Agency here, something called Evil Corps, which is the evil Russian hackers, criminals in Russia, stealing money from Brits and others in the West.
We're here today to identify and announce charges against a Russian national whom the Department of Justice alleges is responsible for two of the worst computer hacking and bank fraud schemes of the past decade. Yakubets is a true 21st century criminal who, with the stroke of a key and the click of a mouse, committed cybercrimes across the globe. He's earned his place on the FBI's list of the world's most wanted cyber criminals.
Fundamental weakness that organized crime has is that they are driven by money and they are driven by greed. And we have been able to gain evidence in the UK of a real world footprint of people seeking to draw down the funds from these offences, and also people who are exhibiting a very extravagant lifestyle online.
So that's the Al Jazeera report there about the Evil Corps. And, of course, the British and the Americans are kind of equivalent of the FBI, I suppose, over in the state. Well, the Department of Justice is the prosecutors rather than the investigators. The UK National Crime Agency shoulder to shoulder with the Americans to stop Russian cybercrime.
Well, I mean, there are Russian cyber criminals without a shadow of a doubt. And there are US cyber criminals and British cyber criminals as well. And we've got people running money through tax havens. Most tax havens, you know, Britain runs plenty of tax havens. Lots of criminals use those tax havens. They use the City of London. The City of London is probably the primary tax haven, because the British tax havens, of course, are not real. If you go to the Cayman Islands, there's nothing there. The money is basically kept in the City of London and just flows through the Cayman Islands on paper. And therefore, London is, in fact, the source, the main source of cybercrime on the planet. The Saudi royals who are stealing put their money in British banks.
Okay, on to Martin Bormann now, finally. And just a little look, Martin, at some of the things that he was involved in. It's amazing, really, that he's such a little-known figure, particularly since he was the organiser of the One Say conference, which was all about the final solution with Reinhard Heydrich and Adolf Eichmann being the main people at that conference. But Bormann was the organiser, but he didn't go. But he married the daughter of Major Walter Buch, who was served as the chairman of the Nazi Party court. So he married into the sort of Nazi Party judiciary process. But more importantly, he was involved in something called the Adolf Hitler Spender, which was a huge fund consisting of suggested contributions from industry. Now, this is something which isn't all that well known about the fact that the Nazi Party actually relied on these enormous donations from people like Krupps and Thyssen, the big steel companies, in order to fund all of its activities. So that's where the Nazi Party was essentially funded from through most of the 1930s.
That's right. And, of course, the Bush family, Prescott Bush, was also involved, ultimately arrested by Franklin Delano Roosevelt during the war for trading with the enemy. And basically there are links of the Nazi Party with the German industrialists, but also with industrialists in the West. They were supposedly the enemy, ultimately, of Nazi Germany.
Well, the architect and armaments minister, Albert Speer, claimed that Bormann used this power for his own financial advantage. Bormann apparently took money from the Adolf Hitler Endowment Fund of German industry that he controlled, and Speer argues that he got away with it because he was clever enough to give some of his money to other Nazi Party leaders. So this is quite a devious character at the heart of the finance of the Nazi Party. Mm.
Well, Bormann was basically the gangster's gangster. He was similar in some ways to Stalin, in the sense that he knew how to keep himself in the background whilst making sure that he controlled the main access to Hitler and, of course, the funds. And as anybody will tell you, that if you want to control something, you need to control the funds and the personnel. And then you're in a position to steer things in the direction you want them to go.
I mean, he was really hated the Slavs, as I said a couple of weeks ago. He said the Slavs are to work for us. Insofar as we do not need them, they may die. The fertility of the Slavs is undesirable. They should use contraceptives and practice abortion. The more, the better. And this is where one of those famous Bormann quotes comes from. He says, education is dangerous. It is enough if they can count up to 100. At best, an education which produces useful coolies for us is admissible. Every educated person is a future enemy.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's their blatant...
That was in a letter to his wife, his own wife, he wrote that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he was not the only nasty Nazi. Let's be clear. But he was a very important Nazi. And as we know, as we've been exploring over many years now, his relationship with the Western intelligence services was also quite interesting, leading ultimately to him being sprung from Berlin by OPJB, Operation James Bond, with Ian Fleming in charge of it, and ending up in Argentina living a happy and successful life and dying in his bed. Unlike Che Guevara, for example, who was murdered by Klaus Barbie's henchmen in Bolivia.
Okay, so that is all for this week. I'll put some links to the Bormann info on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Party's candidate to become Mayor of Bristol next May, that is, Sandy Hoare Ruthven, and Irish public and Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car anywhere you like. Find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday at noon, but do please join us for the Politics Show Results Show with Kevin Cahill at 6 o'clock next week from the general election. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 8.